Text 51551. The Ray Darcy Show on RTE Radio 1.
Now, our next guest was Mayo coroner for the last 46 years and retired from the job in October. And he's come into our Sligo studio. Good afternoon, Pat O'Connor.
Good afternoon, Ray, and good afternoon to all of your listeners. Yeah. Greetings from Mayo and Sligo.
And Sligo. I don't think we have a studio in Mayo, so you have to make the trip up.
Not yet, but maybe after the next government, we might.
Right. We're not allowed to discuss anything of that nature, Pat.
Absolutely not.
And you're a legal man, so you'll go with us on that one.
Well, I understand that.
How long was the trip? Where did you come from to get to Sligo?
From Swinford. It's about 45, 50 minutes up the road.
But I'm well
used to it on the N17.
So we hear the coroner mentioned a lot in the news, and we read about it in the newspaper, but I can't imagine that most people know exactly what a coroner does and what their responsibilities are. So maybe that's a good place to start, Pat.
Okay, well, coroners are a network of people around the country. In all, there's 29 coroners at present. And their job is to look into the circumstances of a sudden and unexplained violent or unnatural death so that a death certificate can be issued. And this may require from time to time a post-mortem examination, sometimes followed by an inquest. What a coroner is not is what people might be seeing on television from America or from Canada. That's not what coroners are in this country or indeed in the north of Ireland. We are coroners are a quasi-judicial. What that means is that they do sit and hold an inquiry into a death. And the purpose of it is to identify a person who has passed away and then to be able to determine the medical cause of death and then to issue a certificate after that. So coroners are generally organised in districts. Usually it used to have been around the local authority area, the county councils. And it's funded by the local authorities, except for Dublin. Dublin is funded entirely by the Department of Justice, and it's a different system up there. I think there's five coroners there now. Right. There's an original one.
And what qualification, Pat, does one need to become a coroner?
Well, coroners are either qualified doctors or lawyers, and at the present time, there of the 29, I think there's 15 of them are solicitors. There's also practicing solicitors. There's 13 of them who are doctors; they'd be GPs, right. And there are two of them who are barristers.
And it's not a full time job, then, is it?
It's not a full time job, though. At the same time, when you're appointed as a coroner, you're on call 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, 365 days a year. So you can get calls at any time of the day and night, and while it's not full time, at the same time it is time consuming and quite onerous.
And you preside over inquests?
Yes.
Yeah.
An inquest is unlike a court that most people, I suppose, have some understanding of: a district court, circuit court, high court, or the courts of justice, the criminal courts and whatnot. It is an inquiry. It's called a court, and it has been that. In fact, it's one of the oldest courts in these islands. It was originally established in the 11th century, and it has come forward all the way from that. So, but at present, just to bring it forward to, I suppose, the 20th and 21st century, the legislation that covers it is the 1962 Coroner's Act. And there have been a few amendments to that over the years, the most significant one being the 2019 Act. And then there was one last year in relation to the appointment of deputy coroners in Dublin. So basically, it's the Coroner's Act 1962 to 2024.
And you preside over it, and you have to make a call at the end about the how, is it, of a death?
Yes,
that's the main part of it, is it, for the family, is that the how?
Yes. I mean, sorry, just going back on the point that you made earlier on, people who have an interest in this or may want to find out more, they can look at two websites, which I would recommend to them. Uh-huh. One is www.coroners.ie. That's fairly straightforward, www.coroners.ie. Yeah. And then the Dublin Coroners Court also have one. It's www.dublincoronerscourt.ie. So that will give a good background to anyone who wants to examine it a bit further. So I suppose coroners, it's important to say, they provide an important public service to the living, and in particular to the next of kin and other people affected by a death. The coroners not only help provide to bring closure to those bereaved suddenly, but also to perform a wider public service by identifying matters of public interest that can and have life and death consequences later. So, I mean, I appreciate, and coroners do appreciate, that the procedures involved in their inquiries, though necessary, may involve and do involve upset for the next of kin and the friends, but the coroners do try to deal with the matter as sensitively as possible, yeah, and with empathy, of course.
Yeah. And we'll come back to the nitty-gritty, but I'm just want to find out a little bit more about you, yep, and your family, because you're a third-generation coroner, which must be unique. Is it unique? Your granddad and your dad both were coroners.
That's right, yeah, indeed. I think there might be one or two others in the country. I'm not entirely certain. Yes, my grandfather, who was also Pat O'Connor, from whom his name I got, yes, myself, he qualified as a solicitor in 1900. And then he became a coroner. He was appointed a coroner for what was then the district of East Mayo. In those days, there were four districts in Mayo, north, south, east and west. As we speak, there's only two left now at this stage. And he was coroner up to the time that he died in 1942. In the meantime, my father had qualified as a solicitor in 1937, and my aunt qualified also as a solicitor in 1941. Some people say there's no imagination in our family, but however, I can say that cycle has been broken by a son of mine who became a chartered accountant.
Oh, right, so there is imagination.
So there is imagination somewhere along the line.
Well, you like a good argument, so I'd say we could argue that one.
Absolutely, absolutely. Yes. So then we come along to my father. He died in 1988, and he had appointed me as coroner in 1977 when I came back from having studied and worked in Dublin for a short time, and joined him and my aunt Moya in the practice. My aunt Moya had been the deputy coroner. So from 1977 through to 1989, when I was appointed as coroner, I was the deputy coroner in East Mayo, a much smaller district. Now, it may be, I don't want to give the impression that we got it simply because we were who we were.
Well, it does beg the question, doesn't it? Like, it sounds very nepotistic, if that's a word.
Well, it's a good word. I think it's possible that people could think that. But the reality is, I was appointed following a public appointments commission's interview.
Right.
I had to apply for the job.
Of course.
Others applied for it as well.
Yes. And your son now, William, is deputy coroner.
He's the deputy coroner, yeah.
And acting coroner, is he?
He's the acting coroner now.
So that'd be the fourth generation.
If confirmed going forward, he would be the fourth generation. But he's qualified as well as a solicitor. Yeah. He's been a deputy coroner for 7 years. He qualified in 2011 and went off to Australia to sow his oats and whatnot for 3 or 4 years, and then came back to me and works in the office with me and was the deputy coroner for all the last few years. But I had to fall off the perch at the end of October when I reached the ripe old age of 72. The law says when you're 72, you must retire. So I had to retire. And then the
And why? So 72, 65 for other people, 66. Why? It seems like a random enough number. Arbitrary. So too is 65, mind you. But any idea why 72, somebody arrived at that number?
I have no idea whatsoever, Ray. I mean, all these numbers are random.
I know, they are completely arbitrary, aren't they?
You have Gardaí, who sort of have to retire at 60, which I think is crazy, to be quite honest with you, in most cases. I mean, judges have to retire at 70. It used to be 72. Most people in the public sector have to retire at 65. Yeah. But the reality is that when people get to those sort of specified ages, they can have a lot of good work still in them.
I'll talk to you about that now, retirement, because I know you're still practicing as a solicitor, so your days are still full, are they, Pat?
Oh, absolutely. Yes. Yeah, okay, indeed. And I as it happens, as of the 20th of November, I was 50 years on the role of solicitors.
Right.
So I'm still going, and I still hope to get, I won't get 50 years out of it, but I'll still get another few decades or so.
You can work as long as you want to, because it's a private company and you can do whatever you like.
Absolutely.
Yes, yeah.
Well, I wouldn't say I would do whatever I like now, but I mean, that'd be pushing it a bit. Of course, and I love it. I mean, I really love getting up in the morning and going to work and meeting people and sort of, you know, getting whatever we have to do from a legal point of view. And, you know, the practice, thankfully, is going well, largely because I have my son there, but I also have four other very, very able solicitors there. And in fact, we've broken the mold of sort of O'Connor to be the managing partner. We have Samantha Geraghty in there now.
Great.
As the managing partner. She was my first trainee and sort of has come through the ranks and is there with me.
And Pat, you're lucky, you know, because people, I think 65 is far too young for people to be forced to retire. I think we need to look at that in a big way because we live longer and we live healthier lives. So to be looking at 65 into 20 years, you could be, you know, you could have 20 good years in you.
Absolutely. I mean, it's the state of the person themselves really should count, not the actual age.
It should be about choice, I suppose, as well, shouldn't it?
It should be about choice. Yes, and I mean, if people want to retire at a particular age, well, so be it. They should have that there. But if they wish to continue or are capable of continuing,
they should be allowed to.
They should be allowed to do that. Yeah. And I mean, say, coroners had to retire at the age of 70 up to 2019, and then it was extended to 72 years. Right. Now, judges have to retire at 70. They used to be up to, I think it was 1995.
72.
Okay,
let's get back to the inquest now, because and the nitty-gritty. So how quickly do they happen after the death?
Well, that depends on the circumstances of the death and whether it's an inquiry. So let me just explain that, you know, the sudden and unnatural, violent or unexplained deaths have to be reported to the coroner. And they're generally reported by either doctors or funeral undertakers and generally by the Gardaí themselves. Now, in the case of a violent or unexplained death, the Gardaí will also carry out an investigation because it may lead to other circumstances which may lead to proceedings in the courts, whether they're criminal proceedings or otherwise. But let me go through the sequence of events. Somebody dies suddenly. The doctor comes out to the scene generally, and the Gardaí. The Gardaí will then phone the coroner and say that there is an unexplained or there's a violent or sudden death, and the coroner will then decide whether or not it's necessary to have the person's body examined for a post-mortem examination. Right. It's sometimes called an autopsy. And if that's done, then the coroner gives directions to the Gardaí, who will arrange to have that person's body brought to the local mortuary for a pathologist to carry out a post-mortem examination. So then it moves into the medical world, where the pathologist, who's not a coroner, will carry out an examination of the person and then will prepare a report based on the findings. And then that report, when available from the pathologist, is sent back to the coroner. Now, there can be a slight delay there in a number of things. First of all, there aren't as the same number of pathologists as there should be right out the country. Not all pathologists carry out post-mortem examinations, right. So that's an issue that needs to be addressed. But also, if there is anything to do with, say, alcohol or drugs, the samples may have to be sent to the state laboratory for testing. And that can take up to, believe it or not, 6 months now, because the state laboratory does a great job. But the trouble is that they, again, are understaffed. And they
6 months to get a reading back on that?
It can be up to 6 months. Wow. Yeah, generally speaking, it's around 3 to 4 months.
Yeah.
But the point I'm really making there is that the pathologist cannot really finalise their report
until they get those results
because they may have a significant effect on what the actual medical cause of death is.
Yeah.
But take that forward just a little bit. The pathologist then issues the report, and the report comes to the coroner. The coroner looks at the report and looks at the circumstances of the actual death that has occurred. And that is generally set out in what's called a form C71 from the guards. And also then the pathologist will make some reference to the actual circumstances. And the coroner must then decide whether or not it's necessary to hold an inquest.
Okay.
In the majority of cases where a pathologist's report is furnished to a coroner, it is not necessary to hold an inquest.
Right.
Not always. So percentage-wise, it's difficult to say, but I would say probably 20% of reports would merit the appointment of, or at least the coroner appointing an inquest and determining the inquest.
Okay. So I'm just reading through your brief and reading some interviews you did and reading some of your quotes from over the years. So there's road traffic accidents seem to be quite common in the inquest situation. Yes. And so too are death by suicide.
Yes.
And just talk to us why those are probably the most common ones.
Well, first of all, I suppose they're unnatural.
Yes.
Secondly, there's an element of violence in relation to the actual passing. And thirdly, there may be an unexplained death or an unexplained circumstance of it. I suppose in the case of road traffic accidents, unfortunately, in the last couple of years, they have started to increase again. There was a time when they were decreasing, but they have increased largely, I suspect, because there's more cars on the road, of course, and there is the lack of attention by some drivers on the road, not all, by some drivers. And it is that lack of attention that unfortunately is causing road traffic accidents, which ultimately leads to deaths and indeed to very serious injuries. And I think it's important to understand also that, you know, for every death that occurs on the road, there's 9 people who suffer very serious catastrophic injuries. Mm. You know, and people can have quadriplegia or brain damage, or, you know, it's they can have paraplegia as well as a result of injuries sustained. And that is catastrophic for the person themselves and for their family and the circumstances.
And it's a terrible tragedy, because all road deaths are preventable, really. But I'm just wondering, is it not obvious how a person dies if they're in a road traffic accident or crash?
Well, it's
why the need for an inquest? That's what I'm asking.
All right. Okay. Yeah. Well, the need for the inquest is to determine the circumstances in which the actual death occurred, because it's not just simply sufficient to say, well, listen, I've identified that person and this is the medical cause of death.
Okay.
Catastrophic injuries as a result. You have to be able to decide the circumstances, because the coroner then must record a verdict in relation to the actual inquest that he's held or she's held, as the case may be. So it's identity, medical cause of death, and then a verdict in relation to the circumstances of the person's passing.
Can you give us an example of that, vague, you know, without, you know?
Well, there are a number of verdicts, for example, that a coroner will consider. One is natural death. Well, I mean, that's, yeah, you know, somebody dying of
no, but in a road accident situation.
In a road traffic accident situation would be, you know, where there were 2 cars involved in a car accident.
Yes.
And a person in one or other or both of the cars sort of passed away. You have to be able to determine, you know, was that accidental or was there a misadventure?
Right.
Misadventure is something that is increasingly being used, not as much as perhaps as in the past, but in the past it was used, but it's important, because I always took the view, or I do take the view, that if somebody goes out and they are full of drink or they have taken drugs and they're driving a car, first of all, it is inherently dangerous. But secondly, it's misadventure to do it. It's not accidental. And that sort of implication, I think, has to be...
What are the implications then if you decide on a verdict of misadventure over accidental?
Well, again, it's important to understand what the law says. The law, Section 30 of the Coroner's Act, is very clear that no finding of responsibility or culpability can be made by a coroner in an inquest.
Right.
So that's left to the other courts, either to the criminal courts if there's a prosecution, or to the civil courts in deciding on compensation afterwards. So the coroner's court doesn't do that.
And in your summations, you've been critical in the past, say, of certain roads. And what happens then if you are very public in your criticism of a particular road? Do people act on that, or do they ignore it, or what happens?
Well, yes, is the answer. It is acted on, but it does take time, unfortunately. And I suppose the two roads that I was particularly concerned about in the Coroner's District of Mayo that I was involved in, one was the N5, which passes by the town of Swinford, where I am. Hmm. There's a 3.2-kilometre stretch there, where there have been a dozen deaths in the past 10, 12 years. That's one area. The other one was the N17 up between Knock and Claremorris. And again, there's a lot of deaths on the roads there. The coroner and I did, myself, make recommendations to the local authority, in the case Mayo County Council, and to Transport Infrastructure Ireland and to the Gardaí, that they should carry out surveys of these particular areas, because it's not coincidence that accidents are happening at the same places. And in fairness, over the last 2 or 3 years, since those recommendations have been made, the Transport Infrastructure Ireland and the Gardaí particularly, and Mayo County Council, have taken steps to try and identify, first of all, the location of those accidents, but also to make the roads more identifiable. For example, people doing U-turns on a road shouldn't be there. So what they've done on some of the roads, they put bollards in the middle of the road to stop people doing that. There is another area, I suppose, that needs to be addressed, and that is the lack of filter roads onto the, particularly the N17 and N5. There's a lot of roads that cross over these national primary roads. And I'm sure it's the experience of other people.
So that's a very dangerous junction then.
Absolutely. What has happened that literally in the last two or three months as a result of some of the recommendations that were made at following inquests and as a result of the pressure from the Gardaí, there has been a speed zone put in on that 3.25. So it's working.
You remember, and people listening would remember, when there used to be huge signage around the country, accident blind spot.
Yes.
Remember those? I haven't seen one in a long time. And it struck me as a young man, I was driving around the country, that if people know it's an accident blind spot, well, why don't they sort out the reason? There must be a reason. And oftentimes it was just straight in the road. So there were fields either side of it. Just cut through the fields and straight in the road, take the bends out of it, and it won't be an accident blind spot anymore.
Well, I mean, that's a very good point, Ray. But the thing is that if you don't see accident black spot signs now, it's probably because those roads have been straightened, and work has been done.
Yeah, yeah.
But having said all that, I have said in the last while, and I know that others have said as well, that really signs need to be in people's faces. They need to be big enough for people to be able to read, not small little sort of signs that sort of you almost have to have a 20/20 vision to be able to see. You need road markings that clearly identify where the road is, where it's going, and also what the nature of the actual road is itself.
It's the three E's, Pat, isn't it? Education, enforcement and engineering. And we need to remind ourselves constantly about that. And it's tragic that the number of road deaths is creeping up again when we were doing so well. And one death is one too many, but we had reduced the numbers in a big way.
Absolutely. Now, the other thing is that just in relation to that, I mean, there's a lot of aggression on the roads, you know, and I mean, not every driver is aggressive. But I mean, I was up and down to Dublin twice in the last week, and the number of cars that come up behind you and starts flashing you know, if you're not, I mean, even if you're sticking to the speed limit, they want to overtake you. I mean,
that always existed.
Oh, it did. Yeah.
Okay. Now, accidental versus death by suicide, and this is an emotional laden topic, isn't it?
It is, very much so. I mean, death by suicide is really extraordinarily difficult for the next of kin and family, because it leaves so many questions unanswered. You know, why was it done? Why did I not see it? What was going on in the person's mind? You know, how come he or she didn't talk to me? You know, why? Hmm. And really, the only person who can answer that, unfortunately, is the person who's passed away. And while evidence of stress can be understood, and I suppose, dare I say, you know, mental illness can be identified, that's the obvious ones, but it's the ones, the silent ones, that are the ones that you have to really be careful for. And it's very, very difficult, really. And it's so sad to see, particularly any death is difficult. Any death, there's grief. But the most important and difficult one of all, in my view, is a death by suicide.
It really is. And obviously, notes would be included in evidence, would they, at an inquest?
Yes. Well, they give evidence of the, if a note is left, it gives evidence of the intention of the person.
But it may not say the why.
Exactly. And the other thing is that, I mean, certainly my practice was that unless there was a clear indication from the person, whether it's by way of a note or whether it's by way of a text message or something else, that they intended to take their own life and did so, I would not record a verdict of suicide, death by suicide. I mean, it could be accidental. It could be an open verdict, for example. You sort of say, well, there's a question mark there. So it is important, I think, when coroners are recording a verdict of suicide, that there is some clear intention of the person to take their life, you know.
And in your summations then over the years, what recommendations have you made around that, around death by suicide? Because you must see trends, maybe you don't, I don't know.
Yeah. Well, it varies really from place to place. There's no, if there was a trend, you could say, well, yes, here, identify this and apply resources to it. There's a number of recommendations I've made over the years. One is the appointment of a bereavement officer in the health service, particularly in hospitals, and for the mortuaries, for them to have a bereavement officer to be able to talk to the bereaved people and to explain, insofar as it's possible, you know, what's involved, and also, of course, the involvement of a coroner because of the sudden nature of the death. Not all county hospitals, not all regions have bereavement officers.
Right.
A lot of that falls on the shoulders of the Gardaí, and God bless the Gardaí, really, at the end of the day, they've so much to do with the community, you know, and these things are often taken for granted. The Gardaí will appoint a liaison officer in the case of a sudden death, whether it's a road traffic accident or a death by suicide or some other unnatural death. But, you know, the other area where I think is needed is in the mortuaries themselves, because, you know, it often falls on the morticians, and I know in Mayo General Hospital there's three of them over there, and they're the ones who end up acting as bereavement officers. Yeah. And it's not fair on them.
No, it's not their job.
It's not their job. But they do it willingly, you know. I mean, and that's that's the thing.
And then I remember reading years ago, and I met a woman recently, and I won't say where or when because I could identify her, but she had lost a number of her family within a year to suicide. Mm. And I remember reading that once one member of family takes their life by suicide, the likelihood of other members following on is higher. So, you know, the risk is higher for them.
Yes.
And they should be under sort of suicide watch. Mm. And that didn't seem to happen for her. I remember there was a huge case in one of the northern counties about 15, 20 years ago where a young girl took her own life, and then her sister followed months after. So we know that happens, and that, you know, I'm wondering, does that happen, and are people alerted to that?
It does happen. I mean, I've had circumstances tragically like that as well. You know, and what they call copycat reactions.
Yeah.
And I'm sure that there is scope. I'm not qualified really deal with that. But at the end of the day, counselling services are important. And I did make the point recently as well that, you know, people who establish counselling services really are very, very, you know, good, and they really, you know, do intend to be good. But I'm just a little bit concerned on occasions that some of the counselling services that are established are set up through goodwill, but not really regulated and not really, by people who are trained in that particular area.
We've been saying that for years, Pat. Yeah. I don't know when that's going to change. If anybody's been affected by anything discussed there, you can go to rt.ie/helplines. Pat, thanks so much for taking time out to go into our Sligo studio and talking to us today. Fascinating. And enjoy your half retirement. And good luck to William if he gets the new job, your son.
Thank you so much indeed. I look forward to eating that Christmas cake that you were talking about at the earlier part of the programme. You know?
Thanks, Pat. Thank you very much.
Take care, Ray.
The Ray Darcy Show on RTE Radio 1.